From RTE Radio, I'm Neil O'Sheridan. This is Playback Daily.
I was going to say, what hope for the rest of us if Orla Gart got a photo with Charlie XCX? But I was wondering how.
I should have gone hunting for Bono, though. I would have liked that.
I just picked it up today. I think it's just come out in Ireland. 76% of 15, 16-year-olds who use vapes have never smoked.
He was shocked and kind of horrified as to why she was referred for surgery.
Coming up on this What Is All the Wet Stuff Falling from the Sky edition of Playback Daily. Songwriting royalty, Orla Gartland and U2 triumph at the Ivor Novello Awards. How vapes took over your teenager's world. And how one woman avoided unnecessary surgery for her daughter. That's all on the way over the next hour of the radio catch-up show that only ever vapes pure, unfiltered audio goodness. Let's get started with Oliver Callan, who once again deprives us of a morning monologue, but he does have a good reason, because he spent the time instead talking about the 70th Ivor Novello Awards for Songwriting, which were handed out on Thursday night. The winner of Best Song, Musically and Lyrically, was Dubliner Orla Gartland for her song Mine. Oliver got Orla on the phone this morning.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. I've just woken up and I still can't believe it.
It's a pretty cool thing to win, and particularly among the audience that you had in front of you last night. Did you have a bit of a party?
I did. Well, I mean, I was in the bath by about 12:30, so it was as wild as I get. But I did. Yeah, my parents came over for it, and I almost didn't want to get them over for it because I felt there was such little chance of winning. But I was so glad they were there.
Wow, you were up against Lola Young in that category and Fontaine's DC and Ray, who's cleaned up at other awards. It was a good idea to bring your parents along. I know, because I'm looking on Instagram here of your dad. That's Mick, is it?
It is.
More or less dancing in the middle of this glittering awards occasion. I also love how he's rocking the jumper over the shoulders look, which is...
I know, I thought that was very preppy of him. We're not used to such fancy things, so we were just, yeah, we were eating the meal before the awards and we had no clue what fork to use.
It worked from the
there
outside.
There were multiple forks.
As they say in Titanic.
We're not used to having multiple forks.
It was an extraordinary occasion because Charlie XCX had won an award. Robbie Williams was there as well. Block Party, which is from my youth, 20 plus years ago. This is a lovely thing to win.
It is, yeah. And it's my first time ever being at anything like that or having a kind of red carpet experience. But it's a really special one because the category that I was in, it's decided by other songwriters. The panel are, you know, my peers or people through the generations who are actually making music. So it's a really nice awards. There's no big corporate aspect to it. It kind of feels like it's actually really about the music.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's really the same for some of the other awards. So, yeah, I kind of don't ever want to attend any others now. Just one of one.
It's the one to win.
Nailed it, ticked it, done.
It's also a very nice award, isn't it? It's like a sculpture piece you're going to put somewhere.
It is. I think you could do some pretty serious damage with it. It's pretty heavy. But it's now on the shelf. I don't really know what to do with it. But we were kind of in the taxi home passing it around. I almost left it in my dad's bag, which would have been good. It's really solid.
What's your mum's name, since I've mentioned Mick, who's gone famous now on Instagram?
We must give her the same attention. Anne is her name.
You've been having a really lovely career. It's almost like you were trotting along nicely and then exploded with all the millions of listens on Spotify and everywhere else, and the big shows, because I know you're heading off to America on a tour soon.
I've just come back, actually. But oh. I'm going to go back in August. So
oh,
I've just
August.
Been
That's
there for
I
a month or so.
At, yeah. Lollapalooza and then more shows.
Yes, exactly, yeah. It's been definitely a marathon, not a sprint. I've done this job since I left school, and I've never had one big kind of viral overnight rise. You know, it's always been really gradual. But I feel really, I'm very content with that. I'm very grateful because it kind of feels like it's never got bigger than where I'm at that point. And I think if you do get a kind of moment in the spotlight in this job, they rarely come around a second time. And I think I'm quite glad now that all of this is happening at this point and not a few years ago. I feel ready for it, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Very like, good. You're not going to get carried away.
No. And also, like, I feel, you know, something like playing live shows is a real skill in itself. It takes kind of years, I've realized, to kind of become good at that. That's a very different set of skills to writing songs, doing things behind the scenes. So it's kind of nice. Like, I played Olympia like just over a month ago, which is obviously a dream venue.
Yes.
And again, I was just glad that didn't happen sooner. I felt like the show was at the right level for my name to be on that ticket. Do you know what I mean? Whereas I don't know if I would have felt that if it had been much quicker. So it's kind of, I'm very happy with the pace of it all now.
You sound like a very steady, level head, which I'm sure comes from...
Well, thank you, McInan, for that.
Yeah, thank you, McInan. Come here, there's a lot of Irish people in the room last night. Did you get chatting to anyone? Is it one of those occasions where you can do that?
There was. I didn't get to meet Bono and Co. That would have been fun. Mm-hmm. Who else was I chatting with? Everyone else seems to be on their own buzz. Yeah, I probably could have gone hunting for all those people after, but I was kind of just with my table I was sat with. And
you're not a schmoozer.
Reeling in shock. I know. I probably should have been more of a schmoozer than I was last night. It was probably the night to schmooze.
Well, the modesty.
I did ask Charlie XCX for a picture and got rejected. So maybe that bruised my ego enough not to go chasing Bono.
Not by her. Maybe handlers or...
Yeah, she did have some people with her. It was all very chic. I actually really respected it. Like, it was incredibly cool. But there was a kind of a red carpet room that we were brought into after you win that whole bit of the night.
So you've won the award at this stage. You've got your Ivor Novello and you approach Charlie XCX. Can we get a photo?
Well, no, I asked... I wanted to respect her space, so I asked my managers to ask who she was stood with, and they kind of, you know, she was on a certain buzz. She actually probably would have said yes to her credit, but I just thought, you know, you get bombarded at these things.
I always wonder
little lowly me, I wouldn't want to push it. So.
You're way too modest. I mean, I was going to say, what hope for the rest of us if Orla Gardner got a photo with Charlie XCX? But I was wondering
I should have gone hunting for Bono, though. I would have liked that.
That would have been no bother getting a photograph there, I'm sure.
I think they would have been really chilled. Yeah, and I really enjoyed watching them. It's a really rare thing to get to watch them do a kind of acoustic performance. I'm not really sure where you'd get to see that anymore. So
you
that was really special.
Won the fellowship, just to let people know, and all four of them were there, and they all four gave speeches as well, didn't they?
Yeah, all four gave proper speeches, like hearing from all of them, and yeah, just felt like a really rare moment. So I just getting to see them perform, and Lola Young covered their song as well, With or Without You. That was beautiful.
Oh, wow, very nice.
So it was really special, and yeah.
In the photos, we can see you standing beside Brandon Flowers.
Yes, he was doing his press round just after me. Another person I bottled asking for a photo.
Did you? Okay.
But he was great. Yeah, that was so surreal. He was there. Bruce Springsteen was there. Like, it was, yeah.
Oh my God, what a great event. Brandon Flowers strikes me as someone who's very sunny disposition, almost too shiny, just about gets away with it.
He is. Yeah, he's very beautiful and kind of statuesque. Yeah, I was kind of watching him work his red carpet moment, something he's a lot more used to than I am, and it was all very impressive.
Orla Gartland, fresh off the red carpet after winning an Ivor Novello Award for her song Mine last night, talking to Oliver Callan this morning. The parents of a 6-year-old boy who died of cardiac arrest less than 24 hours after he attended an emergency department say they have a lot of questions about what happened to their son, Logan Murphy. Colm O'Mungon, sitting in for Claire Byrne this morning, heard from reporter Barry Lenehan, who has spoken to Logan's parents, Lee and Patrick Murphy.
As the events leading to the tragedy of August 13th last year still fresh in their mind.
He's a sweet little boy. He never give out. He loves his mom, and he's going on first class, supposed to be, this year, and he's friends of everyone. He loves to pray. He prays every night. He's funny. He's a chatterbox. He wants to be a doctor. Yeah, I'd say, that's what I remember about Logan.
We had a playhouse there from there, and he loved it. Like, we just got it. Himself and sister there, she was saying, and the fun they had was massive fun, right? Like, fun and games, you know, like any room they like, you know.
He says that when I grow up, I want to be like a rock star doctor because he loves to play guitar. That's what he wants to do. And he's our baby. He is our baby. And it's just sad. Yeah, he's not here anymore. It's just hard.
He was just a very good little boy, in fairness. I mean, that was Logan, the kind little boy.
talk to me about August 11th last year. It's late at night, and it's perhaps a scene that, that many a parent will recognise when the child comes into the bedroom feeling a bit sick.
He come to me around 1 or 2 in the morning and say, he just said, "Mommy, I feel sick." And we sat down and he start vomiting, and he vomit on the floor and he say sorry. As a parent at that kind of age, they always got a bug. So I thought it's just like a bug. And the morning, but I give Kalpo. Around 12, I ask, "Would you like something to eat?" And he says, "A slice of apple." He just had like 2-3 bites of it. I said, "Are you really not feeling well?" And he says, "I'm not feeling well. So we need to take Logan to the doctor." And we go there and Patrick bring Logan and he couldn't walk.
Carried him into the car, it was fine. Then we dropped Lee at the front door of the doctor's and we were on the back. So when Logan goes to the doctor, so I just got the back of the car, opened the door for him. And he stood outside the car and I started walking away. And next thing I just heard Logan go, "Can you carry me?" he says to me. And I said, "Come on." I said, "Come on." He said, "No, Dad." He said, "I can't walk." He said, picked him up and carried him to the doctor. I went to the doctor and we were not in there long. The doctor lifted up his shirt, pressing his belly. And the doctor looked at me and he said, "You need to get him into hospital straight away," he said. He was concerned like.
Lee and Patrick Murphy there talking about the events of the day. So Logan's condition, Barry, was serious enough for his GP to immediately refer him to the emergency department at Cork University Hospital. What happened from there up to the child's death?
So records show, Colm, how the boy waited at least 5 hours to see a medic. The youngster only had one interaction with a consultant during his hospital stay and was never seen by a paediatrician. Logan's inquest heard how the consultant ordered an urgent ultrasound the morning of his death, but the result didn't arrive for almost 6 hours and even then was inconclusive, triggering a further request for a CT scan. The youngster died before that could take place. Now, the boy was initially treated for suspected appendicitis. He complained of chest pain and fatigue, his heart rate rising, his blood pressure dropping. And at 3 o'clock on August 13th, less than 24 hours after he presented to the emergency department, Logan collapsed on the ward, suffering a cardiac arrest that afternoon. This was down to myocarditis, an extremely rare and severe viral infection that causes inflammation of the heart muscle. And Patrick and Lee claim more could have been done to help their son.
Logan says, "Mommy, I feel like I can't breathe." I went out and told the nurses there that, you know, my son says he couldn't breathe, that he has a chest pain. Logan says, "Mommy, are we going home tomorrow?" It's just hard because I told Logan that you're in good hands, that we are in the hospital. So I said, "Nothing to worry about. We will go home tomorrow." Yeah, he say a prayer that night and he said, "Am I gonna get better, Mommy?" And I said, "I'm sure you will." But he was crying because he's in pain. And that was about 4 o'clock in the morning. And until the morning, the doctor's first round at 8 o'clock. Yeah, he asked Logan, "How could you rate your pain, Logan, from 1 to 10? And Logan said 9. And he said, "Send him for ultrasound as soon as possible." He said, "It looks to me that it's a viral infection. We're waiting for it. We're waiting for the scan. We're waiting for it because that's what the doctor ordered."
You felt he was deteriorating before your eyes.
Yes. His color changes from white, pale to purple. So I asked for the doctor. I said, "I need to speak to the doctor. I need a doctor." How many times I go out to them to ask for doctors? I need help.
And this is on the stage then where Logan said to me, said they had to go poop. My wife helped my son up in the commode, and she got the commode put it away. Then Logan laid down and looked over at him, and I said to him, "I'm going to straighten up your neck, small, because you know you get hurt laying on that way." Then my wife came back, and she said to me, "Oh my God," she said, "he's dead." I said, "He's not dead." She goes, "He is dead." And I looked over, and there was nothing, he was dead.
He just lay facing down. He's gone. He is gone. Really gone. I don't know, it's just... You know, like, as a parent, it's just a horrible scene just to see your child die in pain, that there's no one there to help you. even though you're begging for help.
His last words were, I can't take it anymore.
I can't take this anymore, Mommy. But he's not crying. He's just said that I can't take this anymore. If you say that, it means he's in really bad pain, you know, because the pain is there. So I said, like, I'll cry every single day, like, knowing that my son died in agony. Too sad. It's just horrible to think that. So life is not fair. Like, if he requested that ultrasound as urgent, how come it takes like 6 hours to get the result? But no, we were failed. They failed Logan. He's looking forward for his first communion. He tried his suits for his communion. Unfortunately, it didn't happen anymore. It's like I'm having a nightmare, a bad dream. One day I will wake up and Logan will be there. Logan will greet me, good morning, Mommy. You know, that's what we always say. Come to my room and say good morning, Mommy.
So this sudden dating, people just stop throwing around, is not true. It wasn't sudden, it was a slow date he had. There was no symptoms of myocarditis. There was. There was a high heartbeat and low blood pressure. And there was fatigue. And those are telltale signs of myocarditis. That's what we learned afterwards.
What a heartbreaking tragedy for the Murphys. What's happened since Logan's death, Barry?
So last October, the HSE initiated an external review led by experts in Waterford and Mayo to ascertain whether the boy's care, quote, could or should have been provided differently. Now, that review was due to be completed by February. It's now not due until July at the very earliest. At Logan's inquest in April, doctors defended their care, saying that while they suspected a viral infection, they couldn't be certain, and they insisted the rapid onset of myocarditis was shocking. Assistant State Pathologist Margaret Bolster, she told the inquest how myocarditis can be very difficult to diagnose as it has a wide spectrum of clinical manifestations. However, the Murphys' legal team, they argued the boy presented with several symptoms of the condition and they were neither investigated nor diagnosed. The Murphys, they wanted a verdict of medical misadventure. In the end, though, the coroner ruled that Logan died of natural causes, saying that a verdict of medical misadventure couldn't be returned against a hospital in this jurisdiction over inaction by medical personnel. In Britain, inaction does allow for a verdict of medical misadventure.
Barry Lenehan reporting on the tragic death of 6-year-old Logan Murphy and his parents' struggle to get to the bottom of why their son died in hospital. That was on Today with Claire Byrne this morning. On this afternoon's Ray Darcy Show, the Reeling in the Year slot celebrated 2005 in music, news and listeners' anecdotes. Here's a tiny sample of an epic afternoon's memories.
Mary McAleese was the President of Ireland, Uachtaráin na hÉireann. Taoiseach was Bertie Ahern. Our tarnaiste at the time, 20 years ago, was Mary Harney. And Brian Cowan was the Minister for Finance. Camilla Parker Bowles became the Duchess of Cornwall after marrying Prince Charles. The reporter on this is Brian O'Connell.
Some were saying today Camilla Parker Bowles had waited over 30 years for this. Today, the woman whom Princess Diana had blamed for the breakup of her marriage to the Prince of Wales finally became his wife in a 20-minute civil ceremony in Windsor's Guild Hall. Prince William and Camilla's son, Tom Parker Bowles, were the witnesses at the ceremony. There were only 28 close family members inside. Controversially, Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip were not there. Outside, an estimated 20,000 people turned out to see the couple. There was no public embrace. Camilla wore an oyster silk coat with a knee-length chiffon dress. Her hat was designed by the Irish milliner Philip Tracy.
Charles, have you resolved to be faithful to your wife, forsaking all others so long as you both shall live?
That is my resolve with the help of God.
The Big Brother Circus rolled into Dublin. They had auditions in the RDS and John O'Driscoll went down to meet the hopefuls for RTE.
They dressed up, they dressed down. They came in search of their 15 minutes of fame. Big Brother today rolled into Dublin to hold auditions for the first time and there were plenty of takers.
For those who think that reality TV and indeed Big Brother may have had its day, well, there's plenty of people here to prove them wrong. It's 11 o'clock in the morning and there's 200 people here eager to sell themselves and prove why they should be in the Big Brother house this summer.
now would be fit enough to have good sports and play at games and do anything that had to be done, I could do as good as a 20-year-old or a 22-year-old.
I'll just be myself, basically. I'll just come in there, be myself, and just have a personality, as I always have, and just be myself.
I'm looking forward to hopefully bring a bit of madness to that, and, you know, if there's chickens there, look after the chickens, being a zookeeper and all that, you know?
My real job is stripper ground, so it is nice, so sort of fun to be around, always bubbly, fun, you know?
So, Jacob, you're not a real fireman?
No. These here come off here, you see.
You'll go through in groups of 8 or 10 to these picking pens here, and this is your big chance to sell yourself to us and let us know why we should put you in the house.
And after the long wait, there were mixed fortunes for the Big Brother hopefuls.
Disappointed, but sure, we'll try again next year and see how it goes then.
Cheap flights from Ireland resulted in record numbers travelling abroad for holidays. There was an RTÉ News report back in April of 2005 by Anne-Marie Smith.
It's never been easier or better value to travel abroad, and millions of Irish people are taking advantage of it. According to the Central Statistics Office, last year was a record year for travel. Almost 3.1 million Irish people went on overseas holidays, an increase of 7%. The overall number of trips, including business trips, rose to almost 5.5 million. Europe had the largest increase, with more than 300,000 additional Irish people travelling to destinations there. 50,000 additional passengers travelled to North America.
We've got higher disposable incomes in Ireland than pretty much anywhere else in Europe. And one of the things we know is that the more money people have in their pocket, the more inclined they are to spend it on tourism, particularly overseas tourism. I think there's an element of a pent-up demand as well. People are looking for more novelty, more variety.
Last year, for the first time ever, Irish tourists spent more money abroad than foreign tourists did here. Now the challenge for the Irish industry is how to attract the same sort of tourists into the country as those we're sending out of it.
December 3rd, 2005, George Best's funeral was held in Stormont. Close to 100,000 fans travelled to see the funeral of a football legend, one of the best in the world. And this report from Samantha Labrary.
They came from all walks of life, from far and wide. Close to 100,000 ordinary people, touched by the talents of an extraordinary man, lined the streets of Belfast to pay their respect to George Best.
It's lovely to be there. I mean, people might think that only you stand in the rain on the side of the road, but it was absolutely lovely to see him go down there and to be part of that, even though we were only standing in the rain at the crossroad, but it was lovely.
I always vowed that whenever he went, I would come across the water to pay my last respects.
The atmosphere and all was... You had to be here just to get it all clicking in, you know. I would say to sit at home and watching television wouldn't be the same. Wouldn't be the same thing at all.
It's quite sad, but it's quite good in a way as well that everybody does come together.
Yeah.
You know, and pay their tributes, everyone from, you know, different religions and so on. So it's really nice to see him. You know, I'm sure he would be proud.
Audio from the funeral of George Best in Belfast there. Just some of the loads of memories Ray and his team put together this afternoon as they remembered 2005, which was when we all partied. Didn't we? It's Friday, so that means Oliver Callan puts someone through the ringer on his visiting critic slot. This week it's the turn of industrial relations expert Kieran Mulvey. Kieran was sent by the evil Oliver Callan crew to Wellfest, an outdoor health and wellness festival. Europe's largest outdoor health and wellness festival, in fact, according to Wellfest themselves. It took place last weekend, so they got the weather for it at least, in the grounds of IMA at the Royal Hospital in Kilmainham. And Kieran really likes the RHK.
I mean, the extraordinary thing about Kilmainham is it's a hidden jewel in Dublin. And then this contrast between the great British legacy that they left us with that.
Yeah.
And then down the avenue, you have the opposite, Kilmainham Jail,
right,
which
yeah.
is the other end of the spectrum. But I walked in. First of all, I was coming up the gates and I felt I was the only person not with a prayer mat. They all had these yoga mats under them. And I'm wondering, why didn't Oliver supply? Was I supposed to pick up a mat somewhere?
Did we forget to?
So I went in anyway, and the most extraordinary, spectacular event, the extraordinary number of young people are as I call young people, anybody up to 40 is young to me. But largely women, by the way, I'd have to say 80% yeah. were women.
80% as much yeah. as that.
But all with yoga mats and then into all kinds of presentations going on from stages all around the venue, different stages. You could be doing yoga, Pilates, aerobics at any one time. I must say the gyrations were beyond me. I wasn't... it reminded me of my worst days as in the discos in Leeson Street, trying to do my John Travolta number. But extraordinary
flexible
fitness. The interest yeah. of people in fitness, like when you see it in that great manifestation all around the grounds and all elements of age groups, like
yeah.
I think I brought the average age group up by about 30 or 40 years, but whatever. Then the nutrition. I've been diagnosed recently with rheumatoid arthritis. So,
really?
And it's had a side effect a little bit on my lungs. But I'm into nutrition now and healthy living. And I always thought I was, but all the tents. I went around all the tents looking at new nutritional products, mm-hmm. particularly around magnesium and other and CBD oils and all of this. So apart from picking up a load of freebies, which I'm notorious for, I bought a number of products.
The house is full.
And what I was amazed about was the number of Irish companies that are producing nutritional products and marketing them. Mm-hmm. And of course, if I may just say, I'm chairman of Unpost and we're putting a big effort now into Irish SMEs and the export market.
Right.
So I'm hoping we can do something for these new startups.
Working. You're always working.
Well, look, I love my country. I love the people in my country and I want to do the best for my country wherever it
so that's where you're manifests. Isn't that amazing that
yeah.
you spotted
it's
this
extraordinary. And they're all, you know, entrepreneurs, all young entrepreneurs. There was a time when this nation didn't have any entrepreneurs. Then we had too many of the wrong kind, and now we back to. But all of them young, vibrant, energetic, very helpful, very courteous, very nice, spend a large amount of time. And then there was quite a lot of lectures on nutrition. I popped into one or two of them, and then there was one on orgasm. I didn't go to that one, but...
Did you skip that one?
Well, I was tempted, but I said...
Imagine the crack of
life
the cricket.
Goes on.
The crack of the cricket.
Well, yes, I just noticed it on the programme, so I said, oh, interesting.
So, we'll never know what was going on in that tent.
I'll go back next year if okay, you invite great, me. We'll I'll get the courage.
Think of the free samples. Anyway.
Oh, yes. No, we won't go there, will we?
Wellfest in general, you could see it was...
Oh, it was really extraordinary.
Predominantly young people, which is...
Very young.
Because older people need to go to
I think things, people of my generation really need to go because nutrition is so important. Exercise is so important. And to be living an outdoor life... We get into sedentary existence. The weather doesn't help us sometimes around the winter period. But there are alternatives. So many indoor facilities in this country.
No excuses.
And clubs.
To get out and do something.
Get out. Get walking. Get moving. Get swimming.
Beautiful walks, by the way, around Kilmaine. And that's what most people do.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Dublinate.
Well, yeah. Well, I always say Irish people discovered Ireland during COVID. Mm-hmm. All the parks,
yeah.
all the trails, all the mountain trails, all the heritage centres. You know, we have a beautiful country.
They discovered the north as well. People in the north tell me, oh, they hadn't seen southerners until the lockdown rules were different and they came up to
They didn't know about Bushmills.
Well,
and the Giant's Causeway.
Be in a blind eye for good reasons for a period. Come here, the rheumatoid arthritis, is it painful?
You can't judge inflammation.
Yeah.
And I did get a lot of physio because I thought I had some dislocation or muscle.
It only came upon you recently,
then,
did it?
Yeah, I went for a diagnosis in the Beacon Hospital and my professor, Professor Cade, says, Kieran, you have rheumatoid arthritis.
Oh.
I mean, it came as a shock to me because I never really suffered any physical pain, thankfully. And I'm getting my infusions now every month. They're very helpful. I'm on the occasional anti-inflammatories or I have occasionally go on steroids to manage the pain. But it just flares.
Yeah.
And then it becomes discomfort. You know, it's nothing much you can do about it.
It's affecting your life.
it has slowed me down a little bit in terms of walking. Not doing any swimming at the moment, even though I got a personal trainer recently.
Did you?
Yeah. Pam, and she's getting me back in the pool, and I'm resisting getting back in the pool. I said, it's too cold. But I try to do that, and she's helpful to me.
Oh, that's good. Well, I hope you can find some way around it, because there is
full cure. It's managing it and being aware of it and what to eat, not to eat, what to do. Look, it's a malady, but it's not life-threatening. I don't have to be sitting in a particular chair or be wheeled around. You manage this, you take a positivity towards it. There. And thankfully, I don't have... The C word doesn't appear anywhere in my diagnosis, or osteoporosis. So I'm lucky. I look upon it being
lucky.
You always
look positive.
And you know what's wrong, so you know what to deal with.
Do you have to not drink? I don't know if you ever did drink.
I'm not a great drinker.
All right.
Okay. I never was really a great drinker. But I take the odd beer, obviously I like the odd glass of white wine, not so much red wine.
So you haven't had to scale?
Moderate
drinker anyway.
Yeah.
You're from Roscommon. You grew up, you're actually called Kieran because of the place you grew up in.
Is that
true?
Yeah, I was born in a council estate, St. Kieran's Park. Now, it's with a C, and for some extraordinary reason, well, I know, maybe my parents put it Kieran as in the K, the anglicised version. But yeah, I had a lovely life in Roscommon. My father and mother, my mother's well educated. My father wasn't as well educated, but he was a businessman and a mosaic craftsman.
And his mosaic work is, we can see...
Well, it's still evident around shop fronts, around the Midlands and the west of Ireland. Some of his work, repair work in the National Museum and other public institutions. He did a lot of churches and schools. There will be floors and altar areas around that my father had done.
Is he dead a long time?
Oh, yeah. Died when I was in school.
When you were in school?
Yeah, I was just finishing. And... My father and mother died in the same year.
In the same year?
Yeah, my father in May and my mother in December.
God, that must have been very hard.
Yeah, it was, yeah, and it was a difficult time. But thankfully, my elder sister rallied round, my brother James, who's now passed, and the rest of the family rallied round.
It affects you even now, doesn't it?
It does, because I feel over the years... sometimes it comes back to me that they were never there, probably. And I mean this in a modest way, that they weren't able to see my success maybe in working within the country. And they weren't there for my graduation and things like that over the years, different graduations. So, yeah.
You missed them along the way.
Yeah. I think the more you go on in life, the more you're conscious of what they did. They gave me a great education. Mm-hmm. I was lucky to get a scholarship to go to university and then scholarship to do postgraduate work. But it was their grounding. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the one thing about Irish people. You know, we might be peasant nation or a small farmer nation or a small enterprise nation, but education is everything.
Yeah.
It means everything. And the last generation of our parents gave to us a love of education.
A long extract from a much longer conversation Oliver had with semi-retired industrial relations guru Kieran Mulvey, this week's visiting critic guinea pig. Vape shops have sprung up all over the place in recent years, but in the UK at least, steps are being taken to outlaw disposable vapes due to their appalling environmental impact. Here, things aren't happening quite so quickly. This morning, Colm O'Mungoan spoke to Fiona Spargo-Mabbs, founder and director of the DSM Foundation, and to Dr. Paul Kavanagh, chair of the Royal College of Physicians Advisory Group on Tobacco and Vaping. Colm started with Fiona Spargo-Mabbs.
In your work as a drugs education charity, you have concerns about the risks that reusable vapes still present, even when the disposable ones are taken off the shelves.
Yeah, and I don't think disposables will disappear completely, because a lot of them are being supplied illegally to under 18s anyway, because they're not legally supplied to under 18s. So we know that independent shops are already supplying vapes that haven't been produced under UK regulations. So I don't think that will disappear completely. We do have some concerns. I think overall the disposables ban will be really welcome, as you've said. Hopefully it will reduce the numbers of young people vaping. I know it's been brought under environmental legislation, and the impact on the environment is a really important factor in the ban. And the impact of that hopefully will be really positive as well. And hopefully it will reduce the visibility. Well, it won't necessarily reduce the visibility, but it's the disposable vapes in their numbers and colours and flavours that have really seemed to have been the big game changer for young people, where we've seen a real spike in youth vaping. That's been completely in parallel to the advent of the new generation of disposable vapes. And it's disposables that are disproportionately used by young people. Yeah, so hopefully
Why is that? Is that because of the? Is that because they're easier to sell illegally? They're too cheaply bought online, or they just don't require you to. Yeah, go on. Sorry.
Yeah, sorry. They're easily bought in corner shops or newsagents or anywhere really, as well as online. And they're just so easy to use. You know, with reusables, they're a bit faffy. You've got to charge them. You've got to fill the pod. You know, you've got to be quite kind of organised about doing it and quite motivated. But with disposables, they're just there, and you can just put it in your blazer pocket, and they're cheap and they're easy to kind of they're attractive, and that their ease of access, ease of use and affordability are really big factors, as well as, of course, the colours and the flavours and the kind of, and then all the other kind of social factors that are always important in terms of young people's decision making about drugs.
Yeah, they look like toys.
They do, and some of them have got all sorts of features that are added, like lights or things that spin round, or or might be branded to look like something that's very familiar sweet product or something like that. So there's a lot of kind of work done into making them more appealing to young people as well.
So the disposable vapes being, being gotten rid of, apart from, as you say, the health benefits and the environmental benefits, I think 8 million vapes thrown away daily last year in the UK. Mm. The downside of that, if people are going to continue vaping and using refillable vapes, you have specific concerns around that aren't just related to nicotine. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, no, absolutely, and I think it's not going to be a majority thing, but with reusable vapes, there is potential in a way that there isn't with disposables to put other substances in. And we are particularly concerned at the moment about some research that's been done, which has highlighted an issue that had already come our way in terms of the schools that we're working with, specifically around THC being put into predominantly reusable vapes and being used by young people.
For people listening home, that's the psychoactive ingredient in cannabis, tetrahydrocannabinoids.
Yes, apologies. No, that's, yeah. And the concern is not only that, but actually that almost always where young people are getting hold of that, it's not THC naturally occurring in cannabis. It's spice, which is a generic term for synthetic cannabis. So it's a range of substances that can have similar effects to cannabis. They've been made in a lab to replicate the effects of cannabis, but they act on the brain in quite a different way. They can be very, very much more potent, and their effects can be more unpredictable. They can be very much more addictive, and all of that can be much more pronounced in adolescence, because brains are going through really critical period of change. Their bodies are still developing. We've had schools that we're working with, a number of schools over the last year or more, reporting having to send young people off to hospital because of the adverse effects of having vaped something that they probably weren't aware had a synthetic cannabis in. We've been doing some work with the University of Bath, who published a study last year where
us about that.
And their lab produces devices that can test for different illicit substances in things. And they test for spice already. It's something that's quite widely used and causing loads of problems in prisons in the UK. And so they thought, let's see what's going on with vapes. And they got hold of just short of 600 vapes that had been confiscated in schools in England, but in different parts of England. And they thought they might find a small amount of THC but they never thought they were going to find spice. What they found was a tiny amount of THC, but one in six vapes that had been confiscated had spice. And three quarters of the schools that submitted samples had submitted samples that had got spice in. And the effects, as I've said, can be just so much stronger, and especially on teenagers, and especially if they don't know they're getting this. I mean, some young people are actively purchasing cannabis to vape, thinking it will be THC. It will almost always be spice because it's so much cheaper. But some young people, it's being spiked. So they're being passed a vape, or someone's selling them a vape and it's got something in that they're not expecting to be there. And then, of course, the effects, if you're not expecting them, are going to be that often very much more severe anyway. So that is an area of concern. It's a minor concern in proportion to the overall benefits that I think will come from disposables. This is specifically for young people, and specifically for young people that have never smoked. I think that's our main concern. It's a really important public health message that vaping is better than smoking. Smoking, we know so much about how harmful that is for our health.
Okay.
I know that the health harms of vaping are emerging, but it's unlikely it'll ever be as bad. So it's important to hold that in parallel as well. But it's young people particularly who've never smoked. I saw a study, I just picked it up today. I think it's just come out in Ireland. 76% of 15, 16-year-olds who use vapes have never smoked. And that's the concern that we have around young people and vaping particularly.
Okay, and particularly, as you say, because of that potential gateway factor where one in six vapes confiscated in schools were found to have that substance spice in them. Where Paul Kavanagh, he's Dr. Paul Kavanagh, chair of the Royal College of Physicians Advisory Group on Tobacco and Vaping. I'll come to you on this. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Colin.
In Ireland, we're expecting our own ban on disposable vapes to be enacted sometime this year. You'll welcome it when it happens, I presume.
Oh, absolutely. And great news to hear about the developments in the UK. But you're correct, Colm, very similar. And in fact, I'd say more comprehensive measures are underway here in Ireland. So back in 2023, our government prohibited the sale of e-cigarettes to people under the age of 18, which was a very welcome measure. They also put in place new arrangements in terms of regulating or licensing outlets that sell e-cigarettes. That's also very welcome. And at the moment, there's a bill being drafted which will go further. So it will include the measures that we heard about from the UK, which is a ban on disposable vapes. But it will go further. It'll look at other measures, including restricting the advertising of e-cigarettes at the point of sale. It will go further and it'll look at flavours, not just the type of flavours, but also how they're named. It'll address packaging.
That's Dr. Paul Kavanagh, chair of the Royal College of Physicians Advisory Group on Tobacco and Vaping, who, along with Fiona Spargo-Mabbs, founder and director of the DSM Foundation, were talking to Colm O'Mungo this morning about vaping in general and disposable vapes in particular. One of the big news stories of the day was the revelation that almost 70% of hip surgeries carried out at two children's hospitals in Dublin were unnecessary. On this afternoon's Live Line, Katie Hannan heard from Kerry about her now 5-year-old daughter.
At what point was there concerns raised?
So I think she was a day old. The paediatrician came in to do the exam. She said she didn't feel any kind of clicking or looseness, but she listened to me. She was lovely. She said, look, because of the family history, we'll definitely send her for a scan. And then when she was about 10 weeks old, we went back to the hospital for the scan, and that's when they detected it.
Okay, and what did they suggest as a treatment plan at that stage?
So because her hip was actually dislocating, it was coming out of the socket, they said that they needed to do an urgent referral to Temple Street. So within a week, we were in Temple Street getting a Pavlik harness fitted.
And that is, it's a tough one, isn't it, having a baby in a harness like that?
Really hard, yeah. Really, really hard.
Just explain to people, the harness is keeping the legs totally displayed, basically, isn't it?
So the Pavlik harness keeps the hip in place, basically. You know, babies, they kick and everything like that. So the nurse will hold the hip in place and put the harness on just so that the actual ball can't come out of the socket.
Right, yeah. So you can imagine with a little baby how tricky that is, just having to do anything with her at all.
Yeah.
So she had that for 6 weeks, then another x-ray?
Yeah, then another x-ray. We were told we were moving on to the abduction brace. So she was in that full-time, I think, for around 4 months. And then we had another x-ray and we were told she could wear it just at night time and nap time for another 3 or 4 months.
Right, so you were doing everything you could. And I know that I've talked to other parents with that who had a child in that harness. It just means it's almost impossible to manoeuvre a child in that, even like car seat-wise and that.
You have to think of everything. Clothes, you have to get a bigger size. You can't bath them. You know, you have to prepare for everything in advance.
Okay, but you thought, okay, this is it. This will save us, I suppose, from any...
Well, look, we're doing it, but we're not doing it in vain. We're doing it for a reason, you know?
Yeah, that you can avoid the actual surgical issue down the line. So then, when did it progress again then that there was... it looked like she would actually need the surgery?
So we went for an x-ray once she was done with the brace. And about 2 weeks later, I got a call from Temple Street to say that she was being put on a surgery wait list. We'd probably get a letter in a year and then we'd kind of just go from there, which I was shocked because surgery had never been mentioned, not once in any of the consultations. So I was talking to my GP and she said, look, why don't you get a second opinion? No harm. I said, OK, yeah, fair enough. So we did. We got a second opinion with a consultant in Temple Street as well. And he did his own x-ray and said, well, whether she needs surgery or not, there's absolutely no point in doing it until the hip is stabilised. So she needs a spica cast for 16 weeks before we can even consider that. So then she had to wear a spica cast for 16 weeks.
Okay, and what's a spica cast then, Kerry? What does that look like?
It's a plaster cast, basically, from her ankles up to her chest. It's horrible. Honestly, it's horrible. You can't wash them properly. You have to get special adapted car seats, high chairs, buggies, clothes. It was really hard.
But again, you were thinking, this will save us from any surgical procedure.
Exactly, yeah.
So you're putting up with it and she's putting up with it. And okay, so at what point now? What age is she at this stage, Kerry?
Just before she turned one.
Okay. So what was your next encounter with the,
so we went,
medics?
Once the spica cast came off, we went back for another follow-up x-ray. And it was COVID time, so my husband was outside. He was on loudspeaker on the phone. It was just myself, my daughter, and the consultant. And he got the x-ray up on the screen and he said, okay, so good news, the spica cast did its job, the hip is stabilised, but she still needs surgery. So my heart sank. And I said, look, I've been doing my own kind of research and I know there's times where as the child grows, the hip can grow with the child and almost kind of fix itself. Could that be an option? Could we hold off? And I still remember the words he said to me. He said, Kerry, I've been in this game a long time. And yes, sometimes that can happen, but it's quite rare. He goes, I know by looking at this x-ray, that will not happen. The only way that these hips will be fixed is surgery. So I said, okay, put it on the surgery list.
What else could you say, really, with that, referral?
Yeah.
So very reluctantly, you went along with this.
Yeah.
And then an unexpected thing happened for you.
Yes, it did. So this would have been maybe 6 months later. It was definitely a couple of months. And we got a call. So the consultant said that the surgery would be done in Kappa Hospital. So that we'd be referred to there. And we got a call from them, as I said, probably about 6 months later to say it was in and around the time of the scoliosis cases. And I think the consultant was kind of dealing with that. So they rang me and they said, look, you can stick with that consultant if you want, but it's going to be at least 6 months before we can even give you a date for review. Or we have someone else who's taking over some of his cases. You know, you could probably have an appointment in the next month. So I didn't know what to do. This was already our second opinion. I thought, do I want to go to a third doctor? You know, I was kind of happy with the original one. As I said, I trusted that that's what she needed and we were doing the right thing. But I thought, wait, in 6 months, it's too much. So we decided we'd go and they said, look, you can go and meet this other consultant. And if you want to stick with the original one, that's fine. There's no pressure. So we said, okay. So we went in and he was absolutely lovely. He did his own x-ray, explained it all to us in detail. And he was shocked and kind of horrified as to why she was referred for surgery. He said, there's absolutely no way I'm touching these hips. He said, I can see from her last x-ray 6 months ago, they're actually healing themselves. The shape of the socket is changing naturally. So we left her for another 6 months. We went back for review and it just kept getting better and better. And then she's five and her hips are perfect.
A textbook case of dodging a bullet, I suppose. That's Kerry talking to Katie Hannan about her daughter who was scheduled for what sounds like unnecessary hip surgery on this afternoon's Live Line. Finally, on this edition of Playback Daily, Ryanair CEO Michael O'Leary has said that the airline will consider buying its aircraft from China if US tariffs affect the prices of planes they've ordered from Boeing. This morning, Colm O'Mungon spoke to RTE's business correspondent Adam Maguire about the possibility of COMAC planes flying in Ryanair livery anytime soon.
Right, so when Michael O'Leary talks about buying planes from China, what or who is he talking about?
Yeah, he's talking about a company called COMAC, or the Commercial Aircraft Corporation of China, which is a fast-growing Chinese aircraft manufacturer. It was only established in 2008, so very young in aviation terms. You know, Europe's Airbus was established in the 70s, for example. America's Boeing can go trace its origins all the way back to the 1910s. Brazil's Embraer, which is much smaller than those two, that's been around since the 60s. But as hard as it is for a new arrival to break into plane making, COMAC has been making fairly good progress over the past 17 years. More than 1,000 orders on its books. That's pretty much Chinese airlines or airlines close to China. And that's despite it only having two models of plane. It has the C909, which is a smaller jet that carries around 70 to 80 people. Think of it as similar size to kind of the Aer Lingus regional planes. Then there's the C919, which is the one that's really relevant to this conversation. That's the one that's comparable to the likes of the Airbus A220neo, which is what Aer Lingus uses, and the Boeing 737 MAX, which is what Ryanair uses. In fact, Ryanair actually played an important role in its creation because it signed a cooperation agreement with COMAC all the way back in 2011 to help in its development.
Okay, so those contacts are there. Could it realistically be a plane that Ryanair would be interested in?
In theory, absolutely. It's the right size for the fleet. COMAC says it's currently working on variants that will allow it to fit more seats in, which is very important to the Ryanair business model. And you'd imagine if they've been involved in the development over the past decade or so, it would tick a lot of boxes in terms of what they would look for and need. Crucially, it's also well priced, which is very important for Ryanair. The catalogue price of the C919 is around $9.9 million. That's about $6 million below the Boeing 737 Next Gen, which currently makes up the bulk of Ryanair's fleet. It should be said that the catalogue price of a new aircraft doesn't tell you much about the actual price that's paid. You know, they do deals with manufacturers, they get a discount on bulk orders and so on. So they're generally paying well below the catalogue price, no matter what. But there are some crucial hurdles in the way that mean that, you know, Ryanair's threat of switching aircraft supplier probably isn't a serious one just yet.
Okay, give us an idea of what kind of hurdles you're talking about. Are they regulatory or time?
It's a mixture of things, and the biggest one is probably the fact that COMAC, the planes are currently in operation at or near China. As it stands, they're not licensed to fly in European airspace, which is a pretty crucial first step if Ryanair is to seriously consider them. COMAC has been working with the European Union's Aviation Safety Agency, EASA, for a number of years now to secure certification. They had previously said they thought they'd get it this year. They were a bit ambitious with that aim. Just last month, EASA's executive director, Florian Guillemer, said that it would be at least 3 to 6 years before the C919 was certified by European authorities. So you're talking not at least 2028, maybe as late as 2031 before you can actually fly it in Europe. In terms of the reason why it takes so long, regulators, particularly in Europe, are understandably very, very discerning over this. They have high standards when it comes to aviation safety. That's especially true in civil aviation, and probably even more so now. They're more rigorous following those multiple crashes and incidents involving the Boeing 737 MAX in different parts of the world. And it's particularly challenging when it's effectively a new aircraft manufacturer and a new type of plane, because there's no historical relationship between the regulator and the manufacturer. Not much real world data to look at to make a comparison to. No other model, say if it's a variant of an old plane, you can kind of look at the changes. You know, so maybe if you go back to the Airbus A220, which was a new type of plane from Airbus, there was a 2-year gap between its maiden flight in 2013 and it getting EASA approval. And that's a situation where it's a plane maker with a long standing relationship with the regulator, very familiar with the process, and a good reputation as a manufacturer as well. It still took them 2 years. So COMAC is starting from zero effectively compared to that. And the problem for COMAC is that, you know, aircraft leasing companies and airlines, including Ryanair, are going to be reluctant to order planes from them until they know they're going to be given the thumbs up by regulators and they know when they're going to actually be able to use them. They're not going to put money down until they know they can fly these planes.
Sure. Or indeed when they'll be made, because, you know, they're not there on the shelf waiting.
No. And yeah, there's a significant gap usually between a deal being agreed to buy a plane and it actually being received, because, you know, it's not like Boeing or Airbus or COMAC have a stockpile of planes. They're not going to spend tens of millions building these things when they don't have a buyer for them. And the buyer will also want to have them customised. They'll want their own seating layout. They'll want lighting systems that suit their brand, their in-flight entertainment systems or not, as the case may be, and then adding the branding inside and out as well. So if you're an airline, you know, waiting for COMAC to have or be close to have approval from EASA before you're willing to put pen to paper, make a deal, then you're going to be waiting beyond that point of them getting approval. So beyond maybe 2031, before you're actually able to welcome passengers on board the C919. And, you know, this is where Michael O'Leary's threat of cancelling Boeing orders and turning to COMAC and to China looks a bit toothless, because the most recent deal Ryanair did with Boeing was in 2023. It saw the airline agree to buy up to 300 Boeing 737 MAX 10s over the next decade, so by 2033. So there's a very realistic chance that by the time it's feasible for Ryanair to get COMAC jets, it will have taken delivery of all of those Boeing jets that are on the books at the moment, or that order will be complete and it won't have anything left to cancel effectively.
All right. So maybe it's the next big order that Ryanair might take elsewhere.
Potentially, yeah. Although, again, the timing might not be ideal because, you know, they may need to be ordering planes before they know for sure that they can fly the C919. As say, it could be 2031 before they know that. And they might be looking to kind of get an order in advance of the Boeing deal coming to an end. And that all works in the assumption that COMAC would actually be able to deliver on a big order from the likes of Ryanair. You know, one of the issues we've seen in aircraft manufacturing recently with Boeing and Airbus, they've faced a lot of production bottlenecks for various reasons. They're both struggling to keep up with demand. Airbus, for example, last year delivered 760 planes. It has an order book of more than 8,600, so less than 10% were delivered. Boeing, meanwhile, delivered around 350 planes. It has orders of close to 5,600 planes. COMAC, as I say, has an order book of about 1,000 planes. Last year, it delivered about 12.
All
so
right,
tiny,
okay.
Tiny number. So it would need to dramatically expand its production capacity very, very quickly to actually manage to take on a deal from a decent-sized European carrier.
Riveting stuff. Adam Maguire of RTE's Business Desk talking about the exciting prospect of Ryanair buying its aircraft from someone other than Boeing. That discussion happened on this morning's Today with Claire Byrne. And that's all I have for you on this grey, grey, grey edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Sheridan. Don't forget you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio app. And the mothership, that'd be Playback, is on air and in podcast land every Saturday with an altogether better, bigger, brighter look back at an entire week in radio. But for me, until Monday, thank you for listening and good luck.